Is food safe to eat? That's the subject tonight, and I'm just going to present a little material on the blackboard before we begin. Perhaps as a beginning, though, I will give you some one-liners. I'm great for one-liners, and for any talk, you should be able to summarize your talk into one-liners that take less than a page. And so here they are. First of all, I should have the Latin scholars read this. Can any of the Latin scholars see what that is?
Sola.
Yes. Venenum. That's the first point. That says that only the dose makes a poison. Only the dose makes the poison. And that's the first subject I'm going to discuss. Only the dose makes the poison. Another way to say it is, there are no safe substances, only safe amounts. Okay? There are no safe substances, only safe amounts. That's the take-home lesson number one. Well, number two, life processes are for the most part chemical processes. Chemistry is the key to understanding human nutrition and human nature to an extent, because memories and even emotions are chemically based. So that's point number two. We hear a lot about, boy, don't give me any of those chemicals in my food. I don't want any added chemicals. They're all chemicals. All right, that's point number two. Point number three, I have to get a little dig in here. Our dogs and our cats, and I guess most of our livestock, have better nutrition than most of the people in this country. Especially the children. I happen to be a veterinarian. I'm speaking to you tonight from several bases. I'm chairman of the Science Technology Committee for the village, and among our responsibilities has to do with advising as they request on the nutritional aspects of the village and food sources and related matters. That's number one. Number two is I'm very interested in nutrition. My training is that my BS was in agriculture and education. I did advanced work in nutrition. I have a veterinary degree, and my PhD is in physiology and biophysics from a medical school. And I have also served on the Food Protection Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, where many of these things are evaluated. And we have tours of duty in there. They select certain people to serve on these. So it is this from this base that I am addressing you. We have a better nutrition as a people than we used to have, chiefly due to additives, or in great part due to additives. That's point number four, I guess. Number five, additives are better defined than most of our natural foods. Stated another way, there is no scientific reason to believe that naturally occurring substances in foods are more or less safe than man-made substances. Okay? The greatest area of the unknown involves the natural and normal components of our food. All right, some of these subjects I will now discuss.
The first one is very critical. You have the Latin,
and it has to do is an understanding of dose, of which most people do not have today. Will you? Okay. I'm going to give you a little short course in dose effectiveness, since I've spent much of my life in studying dose effect curves with various agents.
And this is a dose effect curve, and this is a given biological effect. What would be a common one? Well, and here's a dose. And we can take sunlight on you. Now, if you have a low exposure to sunlight, and a little more and a little more, there isn't going to be any redness, is there? And but as you increase the dose, the redness will increase. And you can just get so red. And so it sort of flattens out. And most dose effect curves are of a sigmoid type rather than as a linear relationship. Many people look things linearly. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this. At least one comes to mind. If a 150-mile-an-hour wind blows down all these buildings, and I suppose they'd come pretty close to it, and maybe kills maybe 1,000 people in the town, that says that this is 150. This says that that a 75-mile-an-hour wind will kill 500 people, and a 37.5-mile-an-hour wind will kill 250, and it says that a 18-mile-an-hour wind will kill 125, and it says that a 9-hour wind will kill 62, and a 4.5-mile-an-hour wind will kill quite a number of people, doesn't want it. And 1-mile-an-hour wind will kill quite a few people, too. Now, you and I know that isn't true. As we know that this much exposure will sunburn you. Now, we can also extrapolate that, or it works the same way with many of the drugs and other physical agents that I have spent much of my life studying. And so I want you to remember that as we proceed. Thank you very much. We'll just set this down.
It looks as though we ought to take up a collection and buy the camp a decent blackboard.
Well, we got one there, but it says, please save, do not erase. So we probably need two, or maybe something on both sides.
Would some of you scientists be able to figure out I'd like to use a blackboard next week for some Bible studies? But I don't want two gentlemen holding the thing all the time.
All right, we'll...
Is there any way of putting a board on an easel or something so that...
What we'll do for you is we'll have somebody, Edie or somebody, copy down those addresses on a piece of paper and erase it, and you use that board.
Thank you, sir.
All right, now, I guess we can start almost anywhere here. I would like to start with one of the points here. I've already explained to you something about dose, and now something about chemicals. I'll get into the chemical additives in a moment. Let us talk about the hazards of natural foods. Our problem here is that many of the natural foods haven't really been studied for all of the toxic principles in them, but I'll give you a few examples. Now, I push potatoes. I think potatoes are great, but you shouldn't eat too many of them. But if you people who, on the average, eat 120 pounds of potatoes a year, if you ate all of the spuds in one sitting, or better yet, the solanin which is in them, solanin is a very toxic material. And in 120 pounds of spuds, there's close to 10 grams of solanin. Now, 10 grams is about, well, it'll be 10 grams. A better part of my thumb will probably weigh 10 grams. So if you took all of that, which you would eat normally by eating this many spuds in a year, if I gave you all of that today, well, I wouldn't want to give it to you. If I gave it to a horse, it'd kill him. Huh? That's the truth. It'll kill a horse. But you don't have to worry about it because you're down here on the curve, way down here, on low doses. And it makes a difference, you see, whether you take the whole dose at once or take it in pieces, because it's handled and it is not toxic under those circumstances. Apricot jam, and I also think lima beans. I suppose you could apply the same thing there because they have cyanide in them. But that isn't keeping me from enjoying apricot jam. It happens to be one of my favorites. But I don't eat 10 pounds a day or take my whole annual allotment at once. For you who eat shrimp, there's arsenic in it. And so you don't want to live on shrimp or take it all in one time. There's a number of carcinogenic agents in much of the natural foods. Kale, cabbage, much of the cabbage family, the oleraceae, and probably broiled steak. They're among the natural trace elements. There's a lot of trace elements that you are required to have if you're going to be healthy. But given in high amounts, they'll kill you. In fact, and some of them are carcinogenic, probably. Cobalt, for example, is shown to be carcinogenic in the rat. In one study, I don't think it's very good, selenium was shown to be carcinogenic. The data is questionable, but many people regard it as a carcinogen, yet it's a requirement for you. Salt is an additive to food, but it's a hazard. We probably really don't need very much of it because there's enough in regular materials. Cranberries or Norwegians are hung up on lingonberries. Anybody with true Norwegian blood in them like me, lingonberries are sacred. They're part of our inheritance and we should have them. But if I went in my basement and manufactured lingonberries today, I would never get them accepted and get them passed by the Food and Drug Administration. There's no way I could get them passed because they contain such high amounts of benzoic acid. But a little bit of benzoic acid is all right, and I'm keeping on eating lingonberries. But I'm not eating them by the pound. Now, on these natural foods, I'd like to dispel a few things in there before we get to some of the additives. Here are some statements that many people have regarded as true. Chemicals added to foods are poisoning us. Enriched white bread is about as nutritious as sawdust. You should eat only raw fruits and vegetables. Raw milk is better for you than pasteurized milk. Raw sugar and honey are more nutritious than white sugar. If you said they're true, you flunked. If you said they're all false, you're right. There are no safe substances, as I said, only safe amounts. And I've already told you that most of what we eat, they're chemicals. And salt, even our most, as I mentioned, is our most common additive. Not the largest amounts, but our most common additive is salt. And you can be killed by salt, and the amounts that some of you are eating as a result of it, you're going to die sooner because you're hypertensive prone, and salt is one of the worst contributors, I suppose, to hypertension. On enriched bread, on right now, on white bread, compared with, say, whole wheat bread, there is very little difference in their nutrition for you. There's a little more fiber in the whole wheat bread, but the additions from the store, that is, if you buy bread from the store, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about bread here. The additives to the flour take care of those materials that have been taken out by processing the flour. These include the B vitamins, iron, much of it has milk solids in it, and so it is a very nutritious food. What about raw fruits and vegetables? Cooking helps to make many foods more digestible and far more nutritious. Carrots, cauliflower, and spinach are made far more digestible because cooking breaks down the cellulose walls, releasing nutrients within them. What about raw milk?
pasteurization does not destroy the nutrients in milk. When the principal nutrients and the ones vital to us are calcium, protein, and riboflavin. However, it does eliminate disease-producing bacteria, such as typhoid fever, diphtheria, Bangs or brucellosis diseases, which you know as undulant fever, septic sore throat, and quite a number of others. Recently, there was an outbreak of salmonella in California. It's caused by a certified raw milk. What about raw sugar and honey? They are basically sugar. The extra nutrients that are in raw sugar and honey are present in such minute amounts that you can forget about their nutritional contribution. Now, I like raw sugar and I like honey. And I hope that I'm going to keep recommending honey here in spite of those that work in the kitchen. You know, that's a mess to clean up. Every day there's honey on the table. There's honey on your fingers. There's honey on all the implements on the table. And then you got to change honey jars, and it's a mess. But we're still going to keep on having honey here, if I have anything to say about it. Now, what about the natural vitamins? There's a lot of I wouldn't take any of those vitamins that are that you buy in a store. I want natural vitamins. Well, that's a bunch of baloney. Like I say, it's a cross between a crocodile and an abalone. It's a crocabalone. most natural vitamins, so-called natural vitamins, are really small portions of a natural product blended with a large amount of the synthetic. And the synthetic is good because it's the same principal constituent that does it for you. That's that load of hay. Now, let me talk a little bit about additives. Now, additives are not a new invention. In ancient Egypt, they used food coloring. They burned kerosene to ripen their bananas and other things. Marco Polo went off on a big expedition to get some exotic spices. Cortez, what did he go out for? His principal reason was to get the vanilla bean because his associates got hooked on vanilla. The American colonists used sugar, salt, and vinegar as additives, and probably one of the first convenience foods developed in this country was something called, I think it's called pemmican, P-M-M-I-C-A-N. And it was, what they did was to dry meat, and they pounded into it a lot of fat and sugar and acid berries and put it all in a casing and hauled off on a 6 weeks trip. Out in the boonies, and they didn't carry their refrigerator with them because they didn't have one, and they were heavy if they had them. So that's what they did. Another thing they did, they salted things, they pickled things, they brined things, they used dry storage, but they often got messed up because of bad weather and mold would get on things, and before the winter was out, a lot of times things spoiled, the vital nutrients were gone, deficiencies of diseases occurred. And they ended up many places living on cornbread, molasses, beans, and salt fatback. And that's one of the fastest way to pellagra. And pellagra ain't a happy thing. You don't see it much. Most of you don't even know what it is. But that's a good way. It manifests as a dermatitis, GI upset and central nervous system, and sometimes death. Or scurvy was a vitamin C lack. And by the late winter, they were out of vitamin C, unless they were eating rose hips. Now, when I grew up, a lot of people say, well, boy, I wish we had the natural foods when we grew up. Huh? Boy, I'm glad I'm not living then, and I'm glad my children weren't raised under those circumstances. Now, I'll just give you some examples of this. Here in this state, and in the Midwest, some of you older people can remember them. People with great big thyroids, huh? Great big goiters right here. And our animals, boy, we had serious problems with animals. Hairless foals, hairless pigs, big neck lambs, and they'd die because they were weak. And you have, if you have goiters in children where their thyroid is deficient, you have cretins because it affects mentation very much. It has a serious effect on mentation. That's why it's so critical when you have a child newborn and he isn't doing well, you better find out whether that thyroid's functioning or not, because if you don't get to it within a matter of weeks, the mentation will be affected. It affects your mental processes. Now, that's the circumstances here in much of this country in the early days. One of the first experiments on this was conducted in Ohio, 6,000 children. They added iodine to the water and did this experiment with 6,000 children. You could never do it today. There's no way you probably could do it. But they did it today. They did it then. And then they compared it with all the other children in the same area to see what the incidence of goiter would be. And there was no goiter in the children that had the iodized water. And a lot of the other children that didn't have it manifested goiter. Well, that was a pretty good test, and I think by 1924 they were granted permission to make iodized salt. And this essentially relieved the problem in the areas in which this goiter was a real problem, a very serious problem. Some of you will probably remember that we added potassium iodide to the salt. And later on, they found out, of course, that if they didn't put a stabilizer in it, which is an additive, it would volatilize so that it wasn't effective. So they put a stabilizer in it, and then it would hold them. So this was probably one of the first food supplements of a necessary trace element that was added to our food, and I'm grateful for it. And I hope you are grateful for it. Now, what has happened in recent times, however, there was a recent survey to show you how stupid people are. A lot of them now, they go to the store and they'll buy I don't want any of these additives. They buy non-iodized salt in a goitrogenic area. You're in trouble. And on a recent survey, 5% of the people surveyed had enlarged thyroid glands. Now that's kind of stupid, really. I've checked on some of the animals. When I was working for General Electric Company and Hanford Laboratories, I was very interested in the thyroid. I studied the thyroid night and day. And I made some surveys of animals here in the basin, out here in the state of Washington. Found a lot of large thyroids because the farmers weren't giving iodized salt. They were going, getting salt, not looking whether it was iodized or not. That's bad news. Another problem, and some of you will remember it, little children with crooked legs before 1940, because of rickets. And that's a sad thing to watch. A lot of them probably weren't running around today with deformities in their bones because they didn't have enough vitamin D. So finally we got permission to add vitamin D to various things, including milk. So you don't see that. That's not a serious problem today. The problem is, some places they give too much of it. Too much of it is toxic. And a lot of these vitamin pushers, some of them, and some of our younger generation are this way, boy, those vitamins will do it for you. Hamburgers, Cokes, and vitamins. That's a balanced diet. And they take them by the handful, and you can go into toxicity with those. Same with vitamin A. Vitamin B and C are not so much problem with. It's expensive, but they sort of run through anyway. And they're water soluble, so you can excrete them. I mentioned pellagra before 1938. Before we got wise and made some additives to our food, the leading cause of death in 8 of the southern and western states in this country was pellagra. Every spring, virtually all beds in every hospital, including mental hospitals, was filled with pellagra patients. Pellagra manifests itself also in the central nervous system, and GI upset, muscle problems. Now some smart guy came along and says, it's niacin, nicotinic acid, which is one of the B vitamins, that's the deficiency. And some bright people came along and says, well, what should we do about it? And what they decided to do, because much of this area was affected, they were cornbread people. So what they did, they said, we'll put niacin in cornmeal. And when these people start making their cornbread, why, they'll be protected from pellagra by adding niacin to it. Now, there was a lot of God-fearing people who said, what are you doing adding additive to God-given cornmeal? God wanted niacin in there, he'd have put it in there. Well, fortunately, some wiser heads survived, and they did add niacin to many things today, and pellagra is no longer a problem. In fact, 2 years after this problem, after they came up with the niacin bit, a legislation was enacted to allow fortification. So that's no longer a problem. And God bless them for that food additive. Food safety also enhances, or food safety is also enhanced by certain additives. When I was growing up, food poisoning and GI upset was a very common thing. 30 years ago and before, it was a very common thing. Now if there's food poisoning of any sort, more than likely, it's due to food handlers. And it's after the processing. Most of the processed foods today, especially in this country, and in the Scandinavian countries, many parts of the world, they're really good. And that's why one time there was a big incident. Made headlines. It was a flight from Tokyo to Paris. I think it was probably Japanese Airlines, but it might have been Air Chance. I'm not sure of that. And there were 127 people aboard, and they came down with salmonella poisoning. Now, if you've ever had that, I can just see this airplane, 127 people vomiting with diarrhea, running for the John all at the same time. Now, that's impossible in an airplane. I'm glad I wasn't aboard. Now, what was the cause of this? It was a food handler that had an infected sore on the hand that was unprotected. They had salmonella infection, and this was the cause of this whole thing, because there's a toxin in there and it'll do it. That's why we try to be so very careful here. And I think we've been very successful, and that's why anybody that handles food here, you go over and wash your hands in some red soap that just takes off the first two layers. and for anybody handling food, that's what they have to do. If they're sick, they're not allowed there. And when we wash your utensils, they run through the washer twice. All your utensils go through there. We wash everything else once. And after we finish up, we wash over a disinfectant over all of the areas there. Where are the holes in the thing? Well, some of the holes are on the tables and with other people. You people who lick your knives after you go into the peanut butter, huh? You can just as well spit in the peanut butter jar, huh? That's the same effect. So I don't recommend licking your utensils and then going into the peanut butter. It turns me off on peanut butter. And it's also it can be a source of great of food poisoning or transfer of disease. Now, before additives, we had a lot of moldy bread. It wouldn't take long to have moldy bread, or we had ropey bread. I don't know if some of you remember ropey bread. Now the trouble with ropey bread is that you can have this mold in there, and you can run it in the oven, bake it, and it's still in there. Well, some wise person realized that Swiss cheese had something in it that prevented mold. It's really benzoic acid, which is also high in lingonberries. I guess that's why not too many Norwegians are moldy, even if they live in a damp climate. Remember that birthday card? Some of you know Karn, who was here as a librarian. She always sends me these crazy cards, and it was my birthday, and she says, her father's day or something, says, you made a great impression on me, and you molded me. And then you open it up and sign moldy. What they had done then, as a result of this study, they found out that there was enough propionate in 1 ounce of Swiss cheese to prevent mold in 2 loaves of bread. So now benzoic acid is added to bread in many places or some other material. And Dorothy Halverson will correct my nutrition here after I finish. Or her husband, Al. Al washed dishes for me tonight so I could get this talk prepared. And you'll all be disappointed. I should have probably had him help me more, given me more time, but we're doing what we can. But And now, because of these additives, you don't have moldy or ropey bread anymore, unless you keep it in your bread box for several weeks. Some of the food spoilage is very frightening, and I'll take you back a few years on that. Back in about it was 857 about. There was a fantastic outbreak of something that they didn't know what happened. The people became intensely in. They felt as if their extremities were on fire, and it was just a horrible kind of a thing. And then it would turn into gangrene, and their arms, or mainly their digits, would fall off. And this persisted periodically through the Middle Ages. And it eventually called St. Anthony's fire. It was named after St. Anthony, who was who was martyred by burning. And what it really was a fungus in rye. That certain years the climate was such, and so you'd have this mold in the rye, which we have come to know as ergot. We've seen it a lot in animals. We still see it in animals today who eat ergot rye, and they end up with dropping off their tails or their tits from their udders, and it's bad news. But because of watching this, realizing this now, and sometimes adding certain agents to various of our foods, we do not have so many of these. It's a mycotoxin. You'll hear more about this, and they're bad news. There are at least 15 types of mycotoxins, and they're very toxic. They might be toxic to the liver, to the brain, nerves, bones, and some of them are carcinogenic. So they're very bad news. But some of the preservatives prevent this, but not all of them. Some of your aflatoxins from moldy corn and all, they're still around. The latest outbreak of ergot in people was in France in 1951, so it isn't that old. And another very bad actor, and we still see, in fact, we see an increase in it now, and that's botulinum. And this is probably one of the most toxic materials known. It's produced by Clostridium botulinum, which is an anaerobe, and it'll withstand rather high heat as a spore. And what happens then, many people might boil something, preserve it, and then if the situation is correct, so the spores weren't killed, they will develop, and then they will elaborate a toxin. Botulinum toxin, which is killed by heating. But if you don't boil it up to 10 minutes or even just bring it to a boil, you're in trouble. Because to give you the toxicity of this, less than an ounce of botulinum toxin, if spread out through, so everybody got a dose in the United States, it would kill everybody. Just 1 ounce thinned out and given to the population of the United States. It's one of the most toxic agents known. It was one of those it was one of the agents that was considered in biological warfare. It was one of the so-called better agents. And what is happening is there has been an increase in recent times to this, because there's been a big push on home canning, on home preservation of foods, and as a result, we see more botulinum now. We've seen several outbreaks recent past, haven't we? And there was also one in England due to one cannery in Alaska. It was traced to that cannery. But this is a very unusual event to see them in a commercial cannery, to see it. And it was not in the Alaska cannery in which our teacher worked. She worked in another one. I want you all to know that. So watch it. And when you get this, I hope nobody here gets it, but within 12 to, well, from half a day to a day and a half, you get nausea, vomiting, muscle paralysis, you see double, and it often ends in death. Now, we prevent this, and this is a big flap right now, are the nitrates and the nitrites. The big push is now, wipe them out. No more nitrates, nitrites. We don't want it in bacon. We don't want it in ham. Knock it off. One of the problems here is that it may convert in the body from nitrites, goes to nitrosamines, which may be carcinogenic. At least they're carcinogenic in some animals. And a lot of people say, boy, you can't, there's bacon and all, you're adding to it. Well, the reason we've been there have been many reasons for adding nitrite and nitrates to meats. They've been added since, I suppose, the 1700s. And mainly for preservation of hams and bacons and materials like that. It does add color to them, it's true. It keeps the redness in them. But principally it was added to prevent botulinum. And that's what it's still used for today. So that you don't have botulinum with these agents. Now, so then it comes the question, would you rather take a chance on a very remote chance of having a slight increase in cancer, or do you want to take a chance on botulinum? I should also tell you that if you eat normal amounts of ham and bacon, you don't get as much nitrates that way, nitrites, as you do from normal food, spinach, kale, and all of those foods. You get far more nitrates in your normal food. So that's the situation there. But that doesn't say that we shouldn't move to try to get some other substitute. I recently heard that they're looking at another agent now that may preserve as well, and then maybe lighten up on the nitrate and nitrite or remove it. So that's the story of that. I've run out of pages there. Now, the other thing that I wanted to talk about, I better move fast. Another problem that a recent one, I was going to discuss some of the benefits of additives. I think you've heard some of them. If today in your home without additives on a given meal, your salad dressing would be separated and probably rancid in a very short time because you don't have emulsifiers in it. And your bread would be moldy, as I say. And I can go through quite a few of these in which they have been assisted. Now, how are these tested? They have short-term and long-term toxicity for all of these agents. Many of the additives never see light of day because there might not be a wide enough application, and it takes several years to test these, from 2 to 7 years to get anything approved. Many of the tests may take up to 7 years. They have short-term, as I say, and long-term studies in many kinds of animals. And they cost millions of dollars. And you end up so that the dose you might be utilizable is 1/100th of the lowest dose in which you do not see an effect. In other words, they run a lot of studies with these animals. On the short term, they check out all kinds of things and cut them all up and look them all over. And in the long term, they check fertility, reproduction, and they'll go on for at least 2 years and see if on the short-lived animals it affects growth and all and lifespan. And then they have many doses, and at the dose in which there's no effect, then you can add 1/100th of that or less if it still does the job. And that's the rule on additives. Okay? Now, another question that has come up, and to show, when you talk about food and nutrition, at least 3 of my laws apply. I've written down quite a number of laws. It's called Bustard's Laws. And one of the laws states, you can't tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else. Another one is, the trouble ain't that people don't know anything. The trouble is that most of what they know ain't true. And the third one is, there is no complex problem which, if looked at in the proper way, doesn't become more complex. Now, this applies to what I'm going to talk about now. There's a lot of information and misinformation relative to animal and vegetable diets, A lot on vegetarian, much of the present generation and younger generation say, boy, all these meats are all bad, we got to go to something else. And you certainly shouldn't use butter, and animal meats and fats are carcinogenic. Now, I should point out that I have a prejudice in this regard. But I'm trying to be objective here, and I'll cite you the data. Quite a few of us in the business have been very suspicious of polyunsaturated fats for quite a while. I guess it's been about 35 years ago that Tannenbaum did an experiment in rats in which he gave them polyunsaturated fats and caused cancer. Now, a lot of people ignored that, and that happens in much of research, and there was a big push on because they said, boy, this cholesterol, it causes hardening of the arteries, and it's the bad news, so you've got to get something to cut this down, and vegetables are the thing to go, and you go to your vegetable oils, and margarine is far better. So we'll go to these spreads and we'll have these polyunsaturated fats and we won't use lard anymore. And as the data piled up, most of people, I know Keyes at Minnesota made the big push. He said that he looked at the World Health Survey on animal fats and oil and says that this is the big contributor to heart disease. And he was from Minnesota, and people thought everything good can come out of Minnesota. And he had picked these five populations, and it made national and international headlines. And so it got a bad name. Well, there's some things wrong with that. One of the things is that it was not adjusted for caloric intake, the World Health data. And a friend of mine who was a Norwegian at that time when I was working on my graduate work at the University of Washington was a Norwegian there. And he became incensed by this. He says, Keyes obviously selected five populations. I will select another five populations out of this same data, which he did. And he showed that the incidence of heart disease in his five populations had nothing to do with the consumption of animal products and animal fat. In fact, it was more closely related to carbohydrate intake and exercise. But we still saw the big push and the big advertisements pushing the vegetable spreads and the substitutes. They advertise them now. Your additives to your milk. You want to use this terrible cream. You got to put these creams in that have no dairy products in them. And they, unfortunately for you, contain a great deal of trans fatty acids. Some of them up to 56%. And in a recent, last year, there was a definitive report, I think quite well accepted, except by the vegetable oil companies and pushers, that it was a direct correlation that many of these trans fatty acids, the polyunsaturates, contributed to atherosclerosis. That was bad news since people have been advertising for a long time and selling them on the basis that they would substitute for animal fats and then prevent it. Last month, and there was other data to indicate this too, because what you have to realize is that the consumption of animal fat has been reduced since 1990 in the United States. Per capita consumption of animal fat is reduced, although the total fat has increased. The intake of vegetable fats has tripled since 1910 in the United States. The most recent report, definitive report, was Federation Proceedings of in August. And I have the report for any of you who want to see it. Essentially says that they could find no... Well, first of all, I should say, as late as last year, Dick Rauscher, who I know, who used to be director of the National Cancer Institute for the United States, the biggest thing in cancer in the world, is now Executive Vice President for the National Cancer Institute, along with the President of the American Cancer Society. And the President of the American Cancer Society, Clark, came out and said that it appears that there is a correlation between the consumption of fats and the incidence of mammary carcinoma and intestinal carcinoma. And chances are that it's the animal fat that's contributing. Now, in the report out of Maryland that I'm citing now for the Federation proceedings, they could find no correlation on all of the data they had available with any consumption of animal fat and the incidence of cancer, any positive correlations, or in the overall vegetable fat, but they certainly found a positive correlation with cancer and with trans fatty acids. It's data like this, of course, that our science committee looks at, and we're collecting up this data before, and we will probably, if the data continues to look as it is, we will recommend, among other things, to the kitchen here, that we move away from the spreads to butter. It's something I did long time ago, and I'm glad. But the main thing is you shouldn't eat much of either. We don't need that much. The other thing that worries me, and I do push animal products, but not in great amounts. I resist, and I wherever I can, I try to encourage people to change the grades of meat. The grading of meat was set up in 1920. We have a different situation, especially now that we know that the juiciness of meat has very little correlation with the marbling and the amount of fat on the meat. It has more to do with genetics and age, and I've eaten some very juicy red meat that had no fat on it at all and no marbling. So, and 80% right now of the food for cattle in this country comes from food that we can't eat, from grass, and over half the world's land mass is only good for growing material that we can't eat, browse and graze, which animals, of course, can convert to very good red meat. And most of the lambs that are marketed in this country have very low energy intake, and most of them never see grain. My other concern is a very serious one relative to pushing hard on among the cereal grains. We have to change our activity in this regard, and I'll cite you three studies very briefly. That in Wisconsin, that in Iowa, and that in Tennessee over the past maybe 10 years. The most recent one was in Wisconsin, where it showed that the average loss in row crops like soybeans and corn, the average loss of the soil from erosion, water and wind, averaged, I suppose, about 9 to 13 tons of soil per acre per year. This is not consistent with permanent agriculture. I guess the average loss in the corn soil, where corn is grown in any sloping land in Iowa today, is 2 bushels of soil for every bushel of corn produced. Now, until you assign what that's worth, I'm not going to respect the cost-benefit comparisons. And in many places in Iowa, the soil loss is not about 13 tons per acre, but in several places it's been 40 to 50 tons per acre. And that's very bad news. Over in my Palouse country, I am shocked. I was shocked when I came back to Palouse country, where the chief and I spent many wonderful years before and after the war. We came back there, and the erosion was far worse. They had far better management practices before and after right after the war than they had later. It was terrible. And the productivity of that soil has diminished very substantially. But the people are fooled because they use more fertilizer. They use different kind of seeds and put a high input of a lot of materials, so they have higher yields. But if you went back to the old practices, you'd see that there was a great reduction in this. And if you fly over it, you'll see bare tops and the south side of the slopes. And it goes down by the thousands of tons down the Palouse River, never again to be returned. And that's a one-way street. And that's very serious. And what I'm saying is you ought to go to some crops that hold the soil that cattle and other animals eat. So that is one of our concerns. It's a great concern of mine as a conservationist, interested in what the generations that follow me will have after we go. Now, as to recommendations, and our committee does make recommendations, we will. We are very complimentary of what is done here and the way we eat. We might make a few recommendations for them, and if our kitchen and the chief cook, the chief chef, and others, if they come up with suggestions, we entertain them. If they want us to investigate what kind of a floor, and we look at what kind of materials we should have there, maybe in the floor, what other materials we should be using that might be helpful to them, we're open to suggestions. But we have chiefly compliments. One of our suggestions, one of the things we're looking at now to show you the kind of action we do, and Dorothy Halverson's looking into this, Dr. Marion Jacobson, who can't be here because her sister is very ill, who's well known in nutrition circles in this country. We're looking at what about rye? I mentioned rye here as a source of ergot. That does not bother us. But ergot as a but rye as a material that is that many people are allergic to is a problem. So one of the things we're looking at, will it be too onerous to have when you have a rye, be sure people know that it's rye, and then have an alternative for them. Certain people cannot do that. And maybe to announce if you have shrimp or certain materials that a lot of people are allergic to. Some people with shrimp, within 1 minute, they might collapse because they're very sensitive to it. To be sure that if you hide shrimp in something, maybe in a salad or something, and it isn't right away obvious that people know that it's a shrimp salad. These are the kind of things where we're down to the nitty-gritty, you see. So I've been going too long, longer than I planned on. We have a few more minutes, but Dorothy, I want you to say anything you want, correct anything that I've said, challenge any of it, and then we'll throw it open for discussion, or if you just want to throw it open for discussion, that's up to you.
Well, I was over at the bookstore today, and I found this book over there, which is very good. It's A Diet for Living. It's by Dr. Gene Meyer from Harvard. He's retired now.
He tried to offer me a job the other day. You French people will call him Jean Meyer. He used to be a nutrition at Harvard, that's right, he left Harvard, he's at Tufts University now as president.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And he was looking for a new dean for their College of Veterinary Medicine that they're forming up, and he asked quite a few people if they were interested, and I wasn't.
Well, he also has a part here. It tells about fads and fancies in food. I think we've got as many false prophets in nutrition as we have in religion. And
I think a few more.
Probably. Anyway, some of you have probably read some material by Adele Davis, and she has a thread of truth in her material, but so much of it is false that you want to be very careful. And this is true with anything in nutrition. There are new ideas or there's new research going on all the time, so you have to really keep well informed as to what is happening.
And Dorothy came up with a very good suggestion tonight. We're going to make a recommendation on some books, and we'll get them here in the library, of what the best nutritionists are recommending for books. Mm-hmm. And that was a very good suggestion. We'll implement that.
Like there are some publications from National Livestock and Meat Board. There's some publications from the United States Department of Agriculture and from Nutrition and Public Health. And I think we should be aware of these agencies that are putting out good nutrition material. Because too often, if a person writes a book on one phase of nutrition, you have to watch it a little bit and know what you're doing.
And there's a lot we don't know. As I try to tell everybody when I'm discussing such a talk, in the field of biology and medicine, it's a very complex field. And 50 years from now, we look back and realize the truth. That as of 1978, we're rubbing two sticks together, now and then seeing a spark. But that's where we are. I sad to tell you that, but there's so much to know that we do not know. But we've tried tonight to tell you what we do know.
There's a book over somewhere around here. I don't know if it's captioned "A Diet for a Small Planet" or something for a small planet.
It's back on that. Back there.
Diet
is that any good?
Well, there are some errors in that book, "Diet for a Small Planet." So be a little cautious.
But you do recommend this one?
This one, yes.
Well, I have written it down. I'll cross it off now.
There's a new one every week.
Dr. Jim Mayer, I'll ask you to remember.
Yeah, what we can do, what we ought to do, there's some good stuff in that Diet for a Small Planet, but there's some errors.
But
what we ought to do is have Mary and Jacobson go through it and say this is wrong and this is right.
But the average layman who knows very little on nutrition except what you try to find out, how can an average person figure out which is right and which is wrong in that book, and in a lot of other books that are and Mrs. Dell Davis, I've heard so many people talk about her books and her attitude on eggs and other things. So I think the average person is in a quandary.
That's right.
What do you believe? Yeah. One says this and another says that.
All right, I'll tell you what to do.
My mother used lard to make her pie dough. She lived till she was 86.
I use lard.
Yeah, I'd, but don't use a lot of it. The main thing is, and part of this is based on my discussion with a lot of people, and within the family we have a cardiologist who's a very good cardiologist, and of course, a lot depends on your genetics. If you want to live long, you pick a mother with a long lifespan. That's the first thing.
My grandmother lived till she was 96, and she had all her faculties. Till the minute before she died, she had a blood clot and went out like a light.
It's a way to go.
But my own sister died.
The main thing is watch your caloric intake. Don't concentrate on just a few things. Get a good range. And I think one of the benefits here is that they have a real range, and I think we've got the younger generation eating vegetables rather than just meat and potatoes. I think that in itself is a great accomplishment.
I was disturbed when you talked about raw sugar. I read an article written by a doctor maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and he talked about the refined flours and refined sugars. And he said, I want to talk mainly about sugar. He said, according to tests, they have found that the use of refined sugar has caused hardening of the arteries. And he advocated raw sugar. And I have been paying $1 a pound for raw sugar ever since.
Just don't eat much of either one. That's the thing.
Well, I'm afraid that you're fooled with your raw sugar because there's very little raw sugar.
Yeah, a lot of it, they buy it as brown sugar, and what they do is get refined white sugar and add brown stuff to it.
Well, how do you know that?
Yes?
I have two questions, Leon. What do you think about the chemical cuisine poster put out with the center?
Say it a little louder.
What do you think about the chemical cuisine poster and the bulletin board put out by the Center for Science and the Public Interest?
Well, the one outside the library? I was going to...
Or in the dining hall.
Oh. What does it say? I didn't see that.
It's chemical cuisine. It indicates additives and things that are considered safe, ones that you should be cautious about, and ones that you should...
I'll have to look at it.
Okay.
Can you remember some of the agents if you cite them for me? I was going to call attention. I almost brought in... Did you see the headlines in the paper? Just this conference just outside the library in a snack bar. Most of you are busy looking the other way at ice cream. You'd be probably better off reading the bulletin board. That's another thing. We're going to have recommendations on snack foods that might replace some of the ones
May
we got. She had another question. I got her. Then I'll come back to you.
Have you said anything about the increased intake of sugar in the United States? I think we're all addicted to sugar.
Yeah. You don't really need it. And boy, that's tough for me to say because I love salt. And too many people, well, the first thing they do, grab the salt shaker. Gee, I can just see, you know, their arteries turning into pipe stems. And sugar, yeah. If you raise your baby, don't turn him onto sweets, you know. Give him something else. Her?
her? Yes.
Yeah, I agree with the sugar and salt stuff, but I'm also a product of what you call misinformation. What is the source of most of your information?
Well-trained nutritionist.
Yeah, but Leo, I've read a lot of well-trained nutritionists too that say things just kind of opposite from what I said. I mean, I appreciate hearing your views on this, but I think there's also, what this lady had as my question, there is a lot of contradiction. I find a lot of good stuff in Diet for a Small Planet and Recipe for a Small Planet because I think of food as also a justice issue. And I want to know what combination of foods go together to give me as much protein as red beef. And I know you and I have discussed red beef before too, but I really think it's difficult. And I think the main thing is just not to eat a lot of anything. But I think, you know, I have been an organic gardener for many years, and I suppose I always will. I just feel very strongly about putting chemicals onto food. I don't know what accounts for so much cancer in the last 50 years. But there, you know, I don't think we know the story, and why continue to eat things that might possibly harm us? We went through the Kellogg factory, and they take every good part out of rice to make Rice Krispies, and then send it on a conveyor belt and sprinkle it with all the vitamins again. And that just seems ludicrous to spend that kind of energy to make bromated, puffed, bleached white flour, and then add all the nutrients that they took out. I don't understand why
you... Yeah, I'll address some of those issues if I can remember them. maybe we'll start working back. There's three things that happen to you when you get old. The first one is that you lose your memory. And I can't remember the other two. on the cancer issue, there has been an increase in some cancers. There has been a decrease in others. One of the reasons, of course, more people are living longer, and we're saving more children than we used to. That's part of the reason for the increase in cancer. There's been a rather remarkable drop in stomach cancer in the United States. Increase in some leukemias, breast cancer, uterine cancer, probably staying about stable. The fantastic increase in cancer is in the lungs, and where the male population showed a tremendous increase. Now the women are catching up. They're showing tremendous increase due to the more of them smoking. So that's part of the cancer issue.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
A question that I've had in my mind for a long time is that they come up with the names of these diseases like cancer, and she said something like 50 years ago. Okay, but people were dying long ago, and they didn't have a name for the reason why they were dying.
Yeah.
How do we know that cancer or something like that wasn't way back then and just didn't have a name?
Yeah, well, I'm talking about, I think much of what you say is true, but for the good data where you go back to where they had pretty good histology, and you can go back and get the slides and stuff, you can... for quite a while, you can see, like the incidence of lung tumors, for example. But it's true that many posts weren't done, and they died, and maybe they didn't know they had a tumor. That's true. But on the ones that are retrospective, we can see that over a certain period of time there has been an increase. I want to get back to Mary on some of hers. I don't think we disagree on several of the issues you raise. I think a lot of the food is a moral issue, but part of the moral issue that I have on vegetable like soybeans versus meat, I think it's a very big issue morally for me to be raising soybeans and losing 50 tons of soil per acre when you could have grass on it and raising red meat. So that becomes a moral issue.
If they just not then feed them.
Yeah, that's right. I have the same problem with you in that regard. Another thing is on the cereals. I didn't get much into the cereals, and it wasn't intentional, but there's some of them that are kind of tasty, but they have a lot of sugar contents. For cereals, I recommend oatmeal mush. When I get to be dictator, it's oatmeal mush, pretty much. If you want to put milk and raisins in it, that's all right.
Leo?
Yes?
For one thing, they talk so much about the grains that they feed the animals. A good share of that is not fit for human consumption.
Yeah, we have that problem right now in the Palouse because they can't, it's too wet and it's sprouting in the head, and the only thing that you use for is animal feed.
Do you still put all of the additives in the animal feed, like the antibiotics and the hormones and things like that?
A limited amount. I wish we could have time for diethylstilbestrol and some of these. It's a big controversial issue. I suppose you might have an increased chance of having a cancer from the diethylstilbestrol has been used to increase the production of livestock feed. You can produce more livestock cheaper with the small additions of diethylstilbestrol. About 1 to 3% of the cattle, maybe up to 5%, might show some traces of diethylstilbestrol in the liver. You probably can't find it in the meat, in the muscle, and it would and to be equivalent amount of diethylstilbestrol that is given to many women. Therapeutically, you'd have to, on a daily basis, you'd probably have to eat 125,000 pounds of beef liver to equal that. I mean, some of it's out of kilter, you see. And part of it is the withdrawal time. Pardon?
Isn't chicken feed rather high?
What they handled chickens for a while, I think they've knocked that out now. They'd put a diethylstilbestrol plaque in under the skin. And they did that for a while. And I don't think that's especially a good idea. On the problem with antibiotics, I don't know if it's I don't know if all the data is in, and you can get a lot of controversy on a lot of these items. And I say, well, you know, Mary says she's read some nutritionists. I've read some nutritionists, and by very good nutritionists on some matters there is a difference of opinion. But on the pen, what they're worried about is that you might have a sensitivity, develop sensitivity, number one, to it, or number two is that it might not then be effective if you have to take it therapeutically.
The very first one, the first point you made was on hypothyroidism in newborns.
Yes.
It's a Washington state law now that every newborn is tested for PKU and hypothyroidism before they leave the hospital.
Yeah.
And the only way to avoid that is for religious reasons.
Yeah. But boy, I do that. That's very critical. Very critical. I'm sorry we don't have any more time. I'd love to discuss this with anybody.